This week on Art in the Air, we feature an award-winning actress, TV writer, Tracy Dawson, whose first book, Let Me Be Frank, explores women who want to masquerade as men to do things they were not allowed to do. Next, the president and interim executive director of Miller Arts and Creative District, Kathy Long, updates us on the happenings there. Our spotlight is on Meg DeMakis' new book, Maggie's Not-So-Big Move.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM and WVLP, 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant through South Shore Arts and the National Endowment for the Arts. Art on the Air is heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming at WVLP.org, and every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM, also streaming live at LakeshorePublicRadio.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Radio's website as a podcast. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Radio. Information about Art on the Air is available on our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our shows are available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for more information about upcoming shows and interviews. And we'd like to welcome to Art on the Air Spotlight Meg DeMakis. She's been with us several times before, but she has something new and exciting coming out, a book launch on Sunday, December 18th, and it's going to be at the Marshall J. Gardner Center at Miller, and she's going to tell us all about it. Meg, welcome to Art on the Air Spotlight.
It's so exciting, Meg.
Thank you. I'm so glad that you take some time for me and get the word out that I'm going to be doing a book reading and signing at Marshall J. Gardner's Center for the Arts in Miller. And my book, Maggie's Not So Big Move, is kind of like becoming Meg. It's not a coming of age movie book because I'm too young for it, but it is a beginning chapter book, and it's loosely based on my family's experience. We had a family of seven that were uprooted, spur of the moment, ended up in another state. Actually, it was Cincinnati, another state. And as soon as we arrived, we were in like an apartment instead of a house in Miller. I mean, in Hammond, in Woodmar area. We were, all the people on our block were celebrating Hanukkah. And our family was like wondering where the Christmas trees were. And it's a story about how we all became friends and ended up celebrating Christmas and Hanukkah together with all of our new buddies. But it was in this time with the pandemic where the kids didn't have regular school. Nobody had anything regular. That's how it was when we went over to our new place. And we were in an advanced school where in Hammond, we were doing Dick and Jane memorizing words, where they were doing phonics. And we weren't supposed to learn cursive till a couple years later, and they were already using cursive. So our parents had to help us doing all kinds of activities. So the book is full of learning activities and kind of the idea of what families should be doing. You know, you don't really need a village if you've got a family there to help you. And then we had, I'm not going to tell you how it ends, but we had some exciting things when it ended. But I did always want kitten for Christmas, and that was one thing that did happen, which was good.
So Meg, it sounds like there are more books. Are there going to be more books, is what I'm asking?
Yes, in this series, and this is put out by Pennant Publications. I'm working on Maggie's, I'm calling it Maggie's flamingo getaway because my grandparents from Chicago, Swift and Company, you know how all the Chicago people went down to Miami. They went down to Miami and we came down to visit. Only instead of five kids, we had six kids. And so that's coming along. That one is really super too. But, you know, like I say, they're based on my life, but then you have to make them super exaggerated to be fantastic. Sure.
So Meg, were you Maggie when you were little?
Yes, that was me. That was me. And, I wanted to be a dancer. I took ballet at Miss Muffet's School of Dance in Hessville. I took it from when I was four till I was in junior high. So I wanted to be a Rockette, basically, but that did not happen.
I guess what I was meaning was, were you called Maggie rather than Meg?
Oh, no. My name, well, Maggie. If I was called anything, it might have been Maggie. But I wanted to make it a little bit different. And I made the title with the not so big, kind of like the Not So Big Lies. You know, that book was coming, that series was out. They do a lot with that. So I do have a few other projects.
Okay, well, tell us about those.
Right now, my group that is called Family Folklore Foundation, we're working on a project of making a coffee table book, not like Seinfeld, you know, with the actual legs, you know, cream.
Yes.
But it is about how did those buildings come over to Beverly Shores from the 1933 World's Fair. And so we have people painting with acrylics, and we have the work of Dan Granfield that I am making into so a layman can understand. I'm still learning what it's a block and tackle. I'm still learning what a block and tackle is. I almost know it, but I'm making it so the layman can understand. So that's a project that we're working on. And then I'm working on my Gene Stratton Porter historical persona. I'm going to be going in at several places coming up,
should be magnificent.
Yeah, that's fun. I dress up like a flapper for that.
Oh, very good. That'd be worth seeing just for that. I see you in the flapper costume. And anything further down the road you got going on, like into next year? And
let's see, that's three projects. It seems like I might have another one that if I think hard enough. Well, I do teach over at IUN. I teach an online course, Building Blocks for Academic Success. It's for freshmen and new to the college seminar. I think that's about it.
Very good. Well, you know, we got to wrap up here in about a minute, but we want to give you a chance to make sure that we have all the information about what you got coming up at the your book signing and reading and everything.
Okay, so I'm going to be reading selections from the children's book, the beginning chapter book. It takes place around Christmas, and it's ecumenical, which is really great. And Miller is an ecumenical community. They, in fact, have services where they have every kind of religion together. And that was one reason why they were real excited about this. And, you know, on this day of the anti-Semitic things going on, it's very topical. And this is a book that is fun for the young and the young at heart. I call it Tales of the Fourth Grade Nothing Meets Tale of the Two Cities.
Well, it's always a joy to have you on. And also tell us the website about FamFolk.
Oh, okay. It's FamFolkFound.org, or we're on Facebook on Family Folklore Foundation.
Well, we appreciate you. That's Meg DeMakis coming on Sunday, December 18th, 2 to 4 in Marshall J. Gardner Center in Miller. You can hear her read and get a signed book. Thank you so much for being on Art of the Year Spotlight.
Always fun to see you, Meg. Thank you.
Thank you. It's fun to see you too and on the radio.
And as a reminder, if you'd like to have your event on Art in the Air Spotlight or have a longer feature interview, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
We are pleased to welcome Tracy Dawson to Art on the Air. Tracy is the author of the completely engaging Let Me Be Frank, a book about women who dress like men to do they weren't supposed to do, which came out in May of 2022 from HarperCollins. She is an award-winning actress and TV writer who began her career at the Second City in Toronto. She was a writer and lead actor on the Canadian sitcom Call Me Fitz and went on to win the Gemini Award and the Canadian Screen Award for Best Lead Actress in a Comedy Series for her work opposite Jason Priestley on that show. Tracy was born in Ottawa, Canada, and is currently based in Los Angeles, where she lives with her life partner, Isaac, who is a dog. Thank you, Tracy, for joining Larry and I on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome.
Hello. Thank you so much. I love that we got my little joke about my dog, who is, in fact, my life partner.
Well, sometimes they are part of the family, aren't they? Well, Tracy, how we always like to start our interviews out is finding a little bit about you outside the introduction there. So what I want to know is your origin story, how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us about Tracy.
Sure. As the bio says, I was born in Ottawa and grew up in the suburbs of Southern Ontario, Brampton, Ontario, outside of Toronto. And, I thought I was going to be an actress. I was an actress, but like I knew from a young age, I'm going to be an actress. And I moved to Toronto and I just went to see all the theater. And then someone said, you know, you're really funny. You should join our comedy troupe. So I was doing comedy in Toronto on the alternative comedy scene. Then I joined Second City main stage, and that led to a bunch of television acting work in Canada. And eventually I got a green card and I moved to the United States, where I am now in Los Angeles. And I continued to act. And I love acting, but I really was bitten by the writing bug. And what you don't realize when you're young and when you're starting out as a creative, fun person in comedy is that you are always writing. So even though I didn't feel I deserved that title of writer for so many years, I was writing that whole time. And I wrote a play that got produced by a great theater in Toronto and started to write television. And I just was in love with, I love performing. I love making people laugh, but there's something about, you know, having more creative control and wanting to really go back to the origins of being a storyteller, which is what I really felt like I was doing with my stand-up comedy. It was more of a storytelling situation. Anyway, so I had an idea a handful of years ago for a TV project, and I put together a pitch and I was very passionate about it. And we did not sell that TV project, even though we got a lot of very enthusiastic feedback. I didn't end up setting that up anywhere. And so that then became this book, because I did not want to say goodbye to these characters. You know, they're not characters. They're real people from 1400 BC up until today. And I just thought, I need to tell these stories. And so I said, I wonder if this is a book. And so
do you think if you had pitched this show now, it would be more receptive? Because I'm thinking of like Percy Jackson and everything that's happened with historical things. Do you think there'll be more reception for it now?
You know, it's a real mixed bag, because this, if it was, let's say it was going to be an anthology series, and those can be very popular, but they're also can be expensive, right? And so sometimes, unless you have like a huge name attached, like a Reese Witherspoon or an Oprah Winfrey, they can be very expensive and people can be very hesitant, as much as they love the idea, you know.
Or marketing it to a different demographic, maybe like targeting more children to learn about.
For sure. I mean, I'm talking to a few different producers right now. I haven't decided, I haven't like made my love match marriage in terms of who I would want to partner with to try to develop this into a show again, because obviously that's my origin, is writing for the screen, making television and stuff. So I'll keep you posted, because I certainly would love to bring these stories of these incredible women and badasses to as many people as possible. And that could be very helpful to have it be a screen project.
Right, because your writing is so accessible. So I think that, I mean, like, it's in the presentation and the way you've written it that makes it so engaging and interesting.
Thank you.
It's not monotone at all.
Going back to improv, how does that really influence your writing? That's because you're creating on the fly there and actually not putting things down like in a script. But, you know, how does that kind of develop into your writing?
Hmm. That's an interesting question. I think that what improv has helped me do is really be open to not following some specific reined in structure, right? It's just to be open to, what does this chapter want to be? How does this person, this historical figure, want me to tell this story? And like, I'm sort of just remain open and very organic. And I think that that comes from improv, right? Being present, being receptive to, some chapters, they are less funny than others, right? Some are very funny and very snarky, right? And I really lean into the personal, how I feel personally about what's happening. And others, you know, they don't call for that because they're much more serious. They're darker, you know, and so I just tried to be really organic and in the flow when I was writing this. And I totally felt flow. I mean, it was an absolutely lacking angst, as they say. There was no angst in writing this book. And like, that's crazy. Like, that's a crazy thing to say and to have experienced.
Did you let all your friends know that you were writing this? And did people suggest to you? Or how did you go about finding some of these obscure situations that are not evident to us generally in history?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big researcher. I research a lot before I start any script, you know, like I it's like if I decide, oh, this script is going to be set in Chicago or Leeds, England, whatever it is, like I just, before I can start writing, I have to research about it so deeply. And so when it came time to start the book, I realized, oh, like I'm good at this. Like I like researching. It's one of the things I like to do that makes me feel like I've got like a safety net. Like if you just absorb, and then you can kind of go, how do I want to tell this story in my way? How would I sit across from someone in a booth at a diner and say, you've got to hear this, right? Because I want people to hear the story. I want people to feel the way I felt when I learned about them, which is, oh my God, you know, like you want to people to feel it. And so I don't write from a standoffish place, as you could tell from reading the book, right? Like I'm invested. And so I just love research. And I'm not happy with one or two sources. It can get a bit addictive.
It's archaeology.
It is, or like sleuthing. You're uncovering, you're digging like an archaeologist, or you know, you're a detective trying to find that thing that maybe. Because here's the thing: one of the cruxes of the book is that, you know, what gets left off the page? Who's in charge of writing history? And why have so many people, women, people of color, queer people, been left off the page when we know that they did extraordinary and innovative things? Well, because the people that were in charge were the patriarchy, like old white guys. And so, like, that's part of the thing, is like unearthing, like digging for something that maybe such and such scholar or historian didn't deem worthy to write a chapter on. They just wrote it in one line and they put it somewhere. And then, you know, people like you and me would go, wait a second, what was that? You know what I mean? And you want to know more and go, and also sometimes you need to read between the lines in terms of what's not being said and certain things. But
here's a quote from your book by Ethel Florence Lindsay Richardson. There had been much talk in the press about the ease with which a woman's work could be distinguished from a man's. And I wanted to try out the truth of that, of the assertion. It was just like, what kind of statement is that? I can tell by the writing whether this is male or female or other, you know.
Right. And so that author, whose pen name was Henry Handel
Richardson.
So that author was like, you know, F that. Like, this is like, I'm going to write under this male pen name. And also, she very much didn't want to be in the public eye. She very much didn't want to be on display. But she also, you know, had made that statement and wanted to see that it was BS, right? That it's like a lot of the times, like when Jane Austen came on the scene, there was the scholar that I quote in the book who was basically said like that she was the first like worthy female writer like of all time. And you're like, get out of town. You don't know what you're talking about. It's just, it's so minimizing and the erasure that has gone on over the years of people that were like, I talk about Joanna Bailey, right? I sort of almost like a footnote at the end of that chapter. Joanna Bailey, when she was alive, was known as like her day's Shakespeare, right? She was huge. She was the biggest thing. And when she passed away, nothing was preserved. Nothing was archived. And so her memory, like I know people who are just scholars, people who have PhDs, they never have heard of her, right? And so you go, someone could be the biggest thing in their lifetime while they're alive, and then can die. And you go, well, why is that? Well, because it was allowed to disappear. It was allowed to be buried. It was permitted because it wasn't considered important enough to preserve.
You know, Tracy, I was like, first of all, I don't know if people understand the concept of the book. You have 37 women who, even from the title, they might have gleaned this, that have been overlooked and had to take on the roles of men and everything. And I think one section that's very interesting is your anonymous section, where you have like 15 women who, especially literary and otherwise, had to take on the personas of men or hid their own persona. So talk a little bit about that. And then we also want to hear something from your book.
Sure. So Anonymous Was a Woman is this large compendium chapter right in the middle of the book. And basically it's all the literary figures who either wrote using a male pseudonym or who wrote anonymously. And when I started to ask friends who were, you know, big readers, bigger readers than I, nobody that I know knew that in their lifetime, the Bronte sisters only wrote under male pen names. While they were living, they never, ever wrote using their real name. Jane Austen, similarly, while she was living, she never published a book with the name Jane Austen. It was always anonymous. Her first book was by a lady. That was what was on the cover. And so when I saw that so many friends who really love these books did not know this about some of the most famous writers of all time, I said, well, this is incredibly compelling. And then I just started researching and I thought, this has to be a big chapter right in the middle. And the organizing principle that I use for that chapter is Virginia Woolf. And because I was so inspired when I was rereading A Room of One's Own, which is one of my all-time favorite books. It is a book, but of course it's based on these series of lectures that she gave to female students at Cambridge in 1928. I can read a little bit of the beginning of the anonymous chapter here. And here I go. When we look at the women who dressed as men throughout history to gain access and opportunity, or hell, to be left alone, a different sort of disguise must also be considered. Female writers who chose to write anonymously or pseudonymously. All told, disguise isn't quite the right word, since what we come to see is that it isn't a one-size-fits-all situation. There are various contexts and reasons why a woman writer might choose a different moniker or none at all. But hold up, let's ease into this one because it's a biggie. In Virginia Woolf's A Room of One's Own, 1929, the striking mantra that Woolf repeats is that a woman must have money and a room of her own if she is to write. The anger and the sharp, subtle humor of this brilliant woman speak to us through the ages and pages of Room. The book is based on two lectures Woolf delivered at Newnham and Girton Women's Constituent Colleges at Cambridge University in 1928. The constituent part is important here. In the 1870s, women were permitted to attend lectures at Cambridge, but they had to apply for special permission from each individual lecturer. Women won the right to sit for exams in 1881, but it wasn't until 1948 that they were awarded actual degrees, and that was hard won. They tried and tried over the years, but honestly, the men freaked out. A photo from 1897 featured in a BBC.com story about the history of women at Cambridge shows a massive protest by male undergraduates, all dressed in formal attire, wearing hats like fine gentlemen. In the photo, these chaps are mutilating a female effigy in a courtyard at Cambridge, protesting women's rights to attend Cambridge as their equals. So that's fun. As Woolf says in Room, the history of men's opposition to women's emancipation is more interesting, perhaps, than the story of the emancipation itself. One of the most noteworthy moments in Room is the now iconic introduction Woolf makes to Shakespeare's fictitious sister, Judith, who never stood a chance to exist in the first place. Even if she was witty, a keen observer, passionate about life, art, and humanity. Even if she had all the gifts Shakespeare himself had, none of it would have mattered, because Judith would not have been sent to get an education or tended to by tutors. She would have been tending to mutton stew or learning how to cross her ankles under her skirt so as not to create an unbecoming divot. And that was on a busy day. While Judith's passion tries to win out with her limited, non-existent support system, she inevitably succumbs to the depths of unrealized genius, unwanted brilliance, and super dark here, she would kill herself. As Wolfe paints it, she lies buried at some crossroads where the omnibuses now stop outside the Elephant and Castle. The other iconic moment in Room is when Wolfe proposes that Anonymous was a woman. Like poor Judith, Wolfe refers to the suppressed poet, the woman who didn't dare write all that was inside her, and she ventured that Anon, who wrote so many poems without signing them, was often a woman. It's a compelling idea, but of course it's not true. Not every writer who ever signed their work Anon was female, and it would be impossible to know what percentage of them were. In the 18th century, it was considered in bad taste for anyone, even a man, to publish what they had written. But it seems it was doubly unacceptable for a woman. It was considered immodest and embarrassing. The doubly unacceptable part is key here, because the horror of a woman being immodest continued well after the 18th century. There were simply too many ramifications for a woman who had opinions, not to mention one who dared to write them down or advertise them in some way. Wolfe elucidates sarcastically, publicity in women is detestable. Anonymity runs in their blood. The desire to be veiled still possesses them. They are not even now as concerned about the health of their fame as men are, and speaking generally, will pass a tombstone or a signpost without feeling an irresistible desire to cut their names on it. Ha! One can't help but think of a place in the 21st century called the internet, where a woman who has an opinion and has the gall to state it is often met with harassment and even death threats. How little has changed when we have simply moved from unsigned pages to locked Twitter accounts where the wolves are blocked from coming to eat us. Some days, Anonymous looks very attractive. So I go on and on there, and I talk about, you know, this British historian who said that 80% of novels published between 1750 and 1790 were published anonymously. But shockingly, the most of the English novels in the 18th century were written by women. They were not fringe writers. These were not fringe writers. These were people who were central to the development of the novel itself. And if you guys, if you wanted to cut some of that reading, like, into just like a snippet, of course.
It's, you know, was it Louisa May Alcott who made the choice to publish her, what she considered palatable works under her name, but took her lurid and body stuff under a pen name. But she made that very conscious decision, because this is just very interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Because you think, well, is that a writer decision or is that a woman decision? Because, you know, it just didn't make, it just wouldn't have been good business sense, perhaps, to write that more salacious material using the same name as what she wrote Little Women under, you know?
You know, this is like asking a parent who their favorite child is, who's your favorite woman in this book?
Oh, it's an impossible question, as you know.
All of them.
But, I mean, I happen to love Joan of Arc, because I think, like, Joan of Arc is someone in the book, one of the rare people in the book people have heard of, right? But then when you read the story and when you, the way that I chose to write about her, there's a lot that people don't know necessarily. And they might not know that one of the key things that sent her to be burned at the stake was her donning male clothes. You know, yes, she said that she heard messages from angels and from God, and that was part of it. But a big part of the charges was that she wore these men's clothes. And she wore these men's clothes because she was on horseback. She was leading troops. She was a central part of this strategy to win. But also, when she was in jail, she was trying to protect herself from sexual assault by keeping on her male garb. So I love that chapter. I love everything about her. And so that's my answer.
Well, that's great. You know, one quote from you about you that I said I love is, we get knocked down, but we always get up. We always get up. And that, and you wrote that. So I think that's an important statement for women and young women to hear.
I think that if there's anything that I've learned while researching and writing this book is definitely, you know, the statement that's going around right now with after the fall of Roe v. Wade is we're not going back, you know, and you can knock us down, but we are getting up. And the women in this book, I found them to be my companions, my sisters, and they inspire me. And I've had so many messages from people on social media, readers who've read the book and how inspired they have been by reading it. And also they get upset because some of it is upsetting. You're like, why didn't I learn about these people in school? So I'm just thrilled that that they can just like reach through the ages and inspire us anew.
It's so true. Women are showing up in numbers now, supporting each other even more than ever. So,
you know, Tracy, we have just a little over a minute left. We want to know where they can find your book and also how they can find out more about you, like on social media, websites, and things like that.
Great. Well, I'm on Twitter and Instagram, you know, as long as Twitter still exists, I'm there right now. My handle for both Twitter and Instagram is at Dawson Tracy, DawsonTracy. My website is tracydawson.net. And the book is available everywhere. I'm thrilled to say it's all over the US, Canada, the UK, Ireland. I think it's in Australia now. And so please support your local bookstore. Or suggested at your local library, and I hope you love it.
Very good. One real quick thing I wanted to ask you about is the illustrations. They're wonderful. Tina Berning, I believe, has done. They're like all watercolor. They're very engaging.
Tina Berning is a really well known artist in Berlin, Germany. She's got 140,000 followers on Instagram. I highly recommend people search her out. And I was a fan before she did my book. So
how did you run across her before?
I'm like I said earlier, I'm really into research and I dove into that search. I wanted to go to all the corners of the earth. Do you know what I mean? I wanted to find artists who were not necessarily typical book illustrators. And when I found Tina, I said, we're never going to get her. And she said, yes. And we have become very close. I'm going to go there for my birthday in the new year and to Berlin. And I just love her to death.
Well, we appreciate you coming on Art in the Air. That's Tracy Dawson. Let Me Be Frank, a book about women who dress like men to do they weren't supposed to. A book that's a great gift idea for the holidays and Christmas. Tracy, thank you so much for coming on Art in the Air and sharing your book.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Pledge Week for your public radio station. And Art on the Air encourages our loyal listeners to support this station by making a monthly sustaining pledge so we may continue to bring you this great program. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
We would like to welcome Kathy Long to Art on the Air. Kathy, along with her wife, Mary Duggar, started the Miller Beach Arts and Creative District's Farmers Market and serves on the Events Committee and is chair of the Properties and Best Use Committee. Along with Mary, she also creates handmade soap, small glass projects, watercolors, metal arts, and a variety of other crafts. Their studio is called the Glitter Paste Studio. She's also an accomplished commodity broker who enjoys hard work and making a difference. Thank you, Kathy, for joining Larry and I on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome. Hello, hello, hello.
Hello. Welcome, and thank you for inviting me. I'm really thrilled. Thank you so much, you guys.
We love the Gardner Center and Miller Beach District. So thank you.
Well, yeah. Kath, besides what Esther just said in their bio, just maybe briefly talk a little bit about yourself and everything, and then we'll move on to what's going on at Gardner Center and all the things going on at Miller Beach. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I am turning 65 years old in about a week and a half, and very excited about that. I'm also originally from Maryland. My dad was in the military, and that's where we ended up, and I was lucky enough to do all my schooling there. I moved out here in the right at the millennium to work for a large company in Illinois. And at some point I had the opportunity to leave there and move to Gary, Indiana, where I met my current wife, and love it down here at Miller Beach, and just found a lot of opportunities, mostly for volunteering. A lot of towns, you know, I'll be honest with you, a lot of towns don't give you that big opportunity to volunteer and make a difference. And I think the big thing about Miller is that you do have this opportunity to make a difference. And it's not just a bake sale difference. It's real solid difference because there's so much to be done.
Maybe tell us a little bit of the history of the Miller Arts District and what's going on there, just how it was formed and a little bit of the background.
Yeah, the evolution has been wonderful.
Yeah, and it has been. It was founded in 2011 by concerned citizens in Miller, volunteers, Karen and Pat Lee, and Eric Reeves, the late Eric Reeves, as well as Tom and Sylvia Collins. And they came together and they knew that Lake Street in Miller, which was and is a retail area, really is one of the hearts of Miller and needed revitalization. The bakery cafe had closed. Gary Saunders had left it. The last remaining retail shop was the Lake Street Gallery and Joyce Davis. And she was starting to have doubts about whether she wanted to stay. And so Pat and Karen and Eric jumped in and realized they could use the arts as a catalyst for change. The original meetings were at the Douglas Center, just up the street. And the Jeff Gardner family donated this old Miller Drugs store to the Arts District to be used as an art gallery. It's 6,000 square feet. It's beautiful. We have always found extremely good support from the Miller community. And all they ask is that we keep getting better.
You've accomplished that.
Yeah. And one of the things is that, you know, part of our cachet is this gallery, but that's also an albatross, because if you've ever had to deal with a building and improvements and just maintaining it, that is a huge part of your operating budget. And so we started something a few years back, and we're really getting some good traction now post-pandemic, called Miller 500. It's where $10 a month can have the most impact here. And it's all money that goes specifically for our operating costs. And what we ask is we're looking for 500 people in our community of 11,000 to give us $10 a month automatically. And that would cover our operating costs and keep this building going, and also allow us to start focusing on better programming and exhibits and support artists and support, you know, new artists coming into and children's education. And I also believe there's a lot of opportunity for seniors art programming here. A lot of retirees, if they had a place to go to be creative, get them out of the house. So there's a lot of opportunity here for improvement. We have a tremendous exhibits committee now, headed up by Gary Henderson and Nancy Haina. And they're people that moved to Miller because of the Arts District. Gary and his wife, Jennifer Taylor, came from Riverside, and they had started the Riverside Arts District there like 25 years ago and ran it for 20 years as volunteers, and then retired out here to Miller. And because they drove by and they saw an art center and they said, oh, we can move here. And Jennifer Taylor is also the originator of Sparkle House here in Miller. If you've ever visited, or
we've spoken with them.
They're great.
Very exciting.
So, you know, a lot of things came together over the pandemic that really made our current exhibits possible. You know, at the Arts Center, I would say in the last year, we've had some exciting exhibits, everything from quilts. If you had a chance to see the quilts exhibit, it really, for traditional arts folks, they had no idea there was that possibility for the creative outlet of quilts and quilt creating to be an artwork. And it really changed a lot of minds. It was spectacular to see. I'm hoping in the next year or two, in 2024, 25, that we dig in a little deeper to the quilt, artistic quilt making community in Chicago. Apparently there's a tremendous quilt making community that it's not like anything your grandmother made. We're hoping to get that together. Ish Muhammad had a fabulous exhibit here, as did David Sisko. And currently we're closing up Painters Printing, two artists from the Traverse City area, Roy Steens and Angela Saxon. Angela is a native of Miller, grew up here, went to Wirt High School. And that's just another beautiful exhibit that's closing up. And in December, we'll have our community show, which is basically, if you've never exhibited in our gallery before and you are an artist and you're in the community, come on down. And that's been curated by Tristina Pavel, one of our volunteers here, and she's done a fabulous job. So we're pretty excited about that in December. And that goes through to the middle of January.
And that's just the Miller Beach community then, right, for that exhibit?
Gary, yeah, generally Gary. We do say Gary because we are part of Gary, Indiana.
Excellent.
So, yeah, it's pretty exciting. We have a few things coming up in December. We have a trivia night on the 30th. It's the last Friday of the month, and that's always fun. And on the 22nd, we're showing a holiday movie, Elf, which is my favorite. And it's just a good time to get together and just hang out and eat popcorn and have a beer. And January, we're hoping to start Saturday morning art classes. Currently, I'm just obsessed with jelly printing. I don't know if you've ever done any. I think it's a really good, low-cost, easy way for people to create art and get a little exploratory in how they want to do it. And I think that's something that we can charge a very small amount of money and bring people in on Saturday mornings from 10 to 12, occupy the space of the gallery, produce jelly prints, and be able to come back each week if you have new ideas, and do that over the course of the winter so people don't go crazy. It's going to be a tough, tough winter. And on Sundays, beginning at the end of January, we're looking to do yoga and Pilates. Hopefully free classes to the community from 10 a.m. until noon, yoga for an hour, and then a Pilates instructor for an hour. And mostly just to get people down to the space, create community, and teach them their own little routine to take home so that they can practice every day. And not just say, oh, I'm going once a week to yoga. Well, that's not going to do anybody any good. You need to do it every day at home.
I mean, it's like a wonderfully rounded program.
Yeah, and it really is based on what people have said they want to see. So there'll be more classes. There'll be more exhibits. We're looking at probably in 2024 working with folks to put together a birdhouse public art exhibit. We're getting the team together for that and probably try to sync it up with the birding festival that happens in the region. You know, you see those guys in those white vans and they don't have candy. They have birdseed and cameras and, and they are, you know, I think we need to leverage that with some public art and maybe have artists, create, birdhouses and have sponsors sponsor those and have them strategically placed around the Miller community. And have a festival around that, and possibly even an art exhibit that would be bird art. You know, everyone paints a bird at some point, and sometimes they put it on something.
So. Yes. You know, I noticed that, John Kane is also on your board, but there's quite a bit there's quite a bit of coordination between some of the exhibits you've had and with South Shore Arts, where they've been in residence there, and then you take a portion of that exhibit, and they kind of mm-hmm. travel. So is that an ongoing relationship you're going to keep doing?
I'd like to. What's nice about having our current exhibits committee is that we haven't had the need to do that in the past year or two, year and a half. Loved it when we would be able to plug in an empty space. We actually did have an artist back out in August of a commitment and into September. And what was fascinating was David Sisko stepped up and said, no, I'll come. I've got a great exhibit. And it was. And it supported the Water Safety Committee that he created the artwork for all of their messaging and public messaging. So it worked out at the end of the summer that we had David Sisko here. But otherwise, I think we probably would have been dialing up John and saying, what do you got down there? you can send our way. So, it's been, you know, you got to give it to the volunteers here because consistently, it's the volunteers that have done all the work.
You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM.
we do need a new executive director. We're not ignoring that fact. And we do have one or two candidates that have stepped forward to say, this is my vision. And they realize it's a job of managing the business of this organization, and don't have the, I guess, the preconceived notion that they're going to somehow be the creative director. It's two different things. You need to manage the business here. You need to make sure that the thank you letters are sent out to the people that have donated money, and that thank you letters are sent out and that artists get paid on time. That's a real hot button for me, is when an exhibit closes and 2 months later, you still haven't sent the check to the artist for the pieces they sold. I will lose it. You know, it's an ugly Kathy tornado when that happens. So that doesn't happen anymore. You know, simple key things to do right, to take care of your customers, your artists, your donors, and your community, and making sure volunteers are showing up, but giving them a big hug and kiss at the same time, because you can't do it without volunteers.
That's for sure.
Just can't do it.
And you're serving that role right now as an interim until you find a...
Yeah, yeah. I'm the president, so it's kind of fallen on me. I can't back out of that one. But I have, you know, Ann Rose, who's also been with this organization really since the second or third meeting. She has been just tremendous in the last month. She and I have been, basically knocking out a lot of work. We do have a part-time admin, that, came from University of Chicago, managing their film library, Julia Gibbs, who's coming in, and she's degreed from the School of the Art Institute. And she's got a lot of good skill sets that we haven't had prior. So she's being able to, in a part-time basis, come in and provide some structure to creating a database, which we haven't had in 12 years. You know, it's just simple stuff like that that really will make a difference in the next year as to how we get things done. So there's a lot of key people that show up. And, you know, as long as they keep showing up, we're going to keep unlocking those doors. And, you know, I think I'm really excited about the future. I'm, you know, meeting with a contractor tomorrow to engage changing out our big storefront glass and doors with energy efficient windows and whatnot. And City of Gary has a good facade program that should pay for a portion of that. And I know that there's a great amount of interest in this community for a capital campaign to get that done. We got our basement work done last year about this time, you know, got the funding for it last year at this time, so that our basement is completely dry and has been dry for the past year. And we're really excited about that. If we can get those windows and doors replaced, then energy efficient wise, it'll save us some money on that gas and electric bill. But it will also just make the building look that much better and provide ADA access to that front of the building, which is important. So there's, you know, all sorts of things going on in the nuts and bolts of it and the art part. And we do need an executive director to keep that business going because there are a lot of moving pieces to it. And so we're hoping by the end of January to have our finger on exactly the right person to start here. So
are you still looking for candidates? I mean,
we will always be looking for candidates. My biggest fear is that we find someone that we absolutely love. And, you know, 3 days later they call and say, you know, I hate to do this to you, but someone else just called and it's a better opportunity. So I will not turn away anybody that wants to step up and say, hey, I can do that crazy. Because it's a big job and a lot of moving pieces and mostly volunteer coordination and fundraising. If you're good at that, you'll be good at this job.
Right.
And it's, you know, not being worried about someone texting you at 9 o'clock at night. And they're a volunteer. That's usually when they can get a hold of you. And they have time to talk to you, or, you know, having to talk to someone who's bailed out of dough sending out front on a Saturday night. Well, maybe you need to come down and sit there. Mary and I have been doing that for years. And, you know, I always say if you dough sent and you want to sit there for 2 hours, 3 hours, you know, invite your friends down and have a party. I mean, nothing to stop you. It's Miller. You might as well come down, you know, bring a bottle of wine and just enjoy it. you know, if no one walks in, you still, I mean, really, anything.
Time well spent.
Yeah, anything you do in this life, you should make fun. You should have fun with it. It should not be a slog. There's nothing that I do in my life is a slog. I try to incorporate fun. I try to incorporate positivity, you know, because the alternative is dreadful. And we've all done the alternative, in which our lives are just miserable. And you say, well, why is it so miserable? Because I believe it's miserable. Well, if you don't believe it's miserable, make it positive. It's great. You can have a beautiful life.
This is true. Well, a quote from the musical Mame is much like that. It says, life is a banquet and most poor souls are starving to death. So
that's exactly correct. That is correct. Exactly correct. And if you want to be beautiful, make beautiful things. Right. And, you know, beauty's in the eye of the beholder, but whatever's in your heart, make it beautiful and give people love.
Well, I get beautiful emails from Miller Beach about the farmer's market, actually, and it just makes me so happy to see that list of incredible produce and things that you have gathered in that. So how many years has that been going on?
That's been going on. This past summer was our 10th season. I've been involved with it every summer. You know, we went from a 5-hour and that was a slog, 5-hour market every Sunday, in which we had music and crafts and we were doing everything. It was like the Upsy Daisy market with farmers until the pandemic hit. And then we said, ooh, this is an opportunity to downsize. And with help from our vendors, mostly House of Rufus.
Who are brilliant. Oh, my gosh.
Brilliant. And Kate just threw it out there and said, make it 2 hours. Stamper Cheese said the same thing. If you can't do it in 2 hours, then they're probably not going to show up. So we actually got better feedback from our customers about our curating the vendors. And, you know, crafters can't make money in a 2-hour market. So it really did come down to producers and cheese and bakers and farmers. And it's a much better market for 2 hours on Sunday. And it's much easier to work every Sunday at that market than 5 hours. 5 hours would kill your Monday.
Yeah. Now, if somebody wants to exhibit there, how do they get in touch with the exhibit committee? Because I'm sure there's maybe artists that will be listening to this program and be interested in maybe exhibiting there.
So probably in about 2 months, we're going to sit down and talk about our 2024 calendar. Our 2023 calendar is already set. And 2023, if you live in Gary or Miller, we will have a community show next December that we will start curating in August and September. They can email the organization at mbacdarts@gmail.com. They can also visit our website at millerbeacharts.org, and they can send us a message through that website and send us pictures of what they want to do, send us their proposition for their exhibit and anything else they need us to know. And it all goes through the exhibits committee. And we will get back to them and let them know what we think. The other thing is, I know we're running out of time here, but I want to mention the Miller Community Theater, which was a startup this past summer. Marty Grubbs as their director and Jen Ponson's their producer, both Miller folks, and just an outstanding success for their first production, which was the Mad Woman's Late Night Cabaret, and incredible success. Only went one weekend. We had to cancel the second weekend because of the cast got COVID. But they have 3 productions planned here in this building this year. The first one is going to be in March called Pageant Play. The second will be in July. It'll be the Rocky Horror Show live on stage. and then we're going to have a Christmas cabaret in November, which I love the cabarets. The cabarets are just the best. And, you know, I think Marty and Jen have just done an outstanding job right out of the box. making that successful. So we're pretty proud that they're here with us. So definitely watch our website and sign up for our emails. And millerbeacharts.org is our website. And if you're getting our emails now, great. If you're not getting them, but you think you should, contact us. We will update you.
Yeah, sure. They're great emails.
They are. I know I also get them. And yeah, we featured the, I think, we didn't have time to do a full spotlight, but I was able to do what I would call a spotlight extra, like a few seconds about the first production. And someone contacted me and I said, yeah, we'll do that. So in the last 30 seconds here, tell us, first of all, where you're located, everything, and maybe what's going on one last time.
Miller Beach Arts and Creative District. We are located at the Marshall J. Gardner Center for the Arts at 540 South Lake Street in Gary, Indiana, 46403. Our number is 219-885-9114. Our website, millerbeacharts.org. And please contact us. The space, we also rent our space out. It's a 6,000 square foot gallery for private parties, if you'd like. And we're like the Aquatorium South. Let's put it that way.
Excellent. Well, that was Kathy fabulous. Long, president of and currently serving as executive director of Miller Beach Arts and Creative District. And as you gave her the address, and there'll be a link on our website when you click on Kathy's picture. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank
Art
you.
On
I clean the popcorn.
Fabulous. Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Have fun. Thanks, Esther. Thanks, Larry.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art on the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at WVLP.org, and every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicradio.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Radio's website as a podcast. Our spotlight interviews are also heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. Thanks to Tom Maloney, Vice President of Radio Operations for Lakeshore Public Radio, and Greg Kovach, WVLP's Station Manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. Art in the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant through South Shore Arts and the National Endowment for the Arts. We would like to thank our current supporters and underwriters, which include regional art patron Mary Levan and Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art on the Air, we rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art on the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts, give till it feels good, and you'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts-related event or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.